It began with a phone call by a very smart teenager to a non-practicing attorney. It ended with a mountain saved from near destruction, a new legal precedent, and the historic Appalachian Trail maintained for another generation to enjoy. The book Stand Up That Mountain, The Battle to Save One Small Community in the Wilderness Along the Appalachian Trail by Jay Lutze is a classic underdog tale and a true story of an outdoorsman living alone in western North Carolina who teams up with his neighbors to save a treasured mountain and section of the Appalachian Trail from being destroyed. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jay Erskine Lutze to our program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe. It's a real treat to be with you and to be speaking to day hikers from another part of the trail up in your neck of the woods.
Absolutely. This is such an important resource for all of us. How did you ultimately get involved in the story?
Well, I guess you could say I got involved as a five-year-old kid when my parents dragged me into the mountains. I didn't know what I was really getting into as a kid, and we built a cabin not far from the Appalachian Trail out of reclaimed lumber from some old buildings that were being inundated by a water supply lake. And my childhood was spent tacking boards together and building this cabin and falling in love with this national park unit that wasn't far from my back door.
So one day you get a call from a 14-year-old girl, Ashley Cook, and her aunt Ollie. They live in a spot known as Dogtown. They are mountain people, and they tell you the story of a mining company that is illegally tearing down the mountain behind their house, and they want you to get involved.
That's right. It was certainly the talk of the town, the talk of Dogtown, that Paul Brown was bringing in the largest surface mine in western North Carolina up on Bellevue Mountain. But what I didn't know when they called was that they had legal standing to sue. Aunt Ollie, actually, her property joined the property boundary of the permitted area for the mine site. And what started out as just another telephone call in my day from a disgruntled neighbor who was looking for a lawyer ended up in a court case that lasted for 4 years because Ollie Vay Cook Cox Carpenter had standing to sue.
Ultimately, when they called you, dynamiting had already begun. There were explosions that were coming through the trees onto their property.
That's right. There's fly rock, it's called. When you're blasting in granite, obviously the rock flies a long way, and we have mining laws in North Carolina, as federal statutes also reference danger to adjoining landowners from fly rock and from soil coming down the mountain. And this family was in the process of building a new house, and their foundation was cracked by the first blast that the mining company pulled at the site.
So give us a sense of what exactly the company was doing that was illegal.
Well, this, of course, was fodder for the lawsuit. The question became, can you draw your mine map in such a way that you craft the boundary so that within the language of the statute, you don't have any adjoining landowners, so you don't have to notify anybody of what you are going to do? Under our law, you have to notify adjoining landowners, and that's where you find out if there's a school next door or a hospital or a nursing home or a private residence that's too close that will be damaged, possibly causing loss of life. This mining company drew their mine map in a way with a buffer inside their property line and then concluded they did not owe notice to anyone. So they only notified the county manager, and they notified a subsidiary of their own company of their right to challenge this permit.
So there are the members of the community of Dogtown that are involved in this group, but very soon it grew simply because of the impact that it could have on the Appalachian Trail. Besides what could happen to the residents and the neighbors of this project, what were the concerns over the trail itself and this mountain in particular?
Well, that's a good question. I have worked for about a decade for the Southern Appalachian Highlands Conservancy, which is the land trust that was formed to move the Appalachian Trail, about a 17-mile section of it, off of a highway and up onto the ridges on the grassy balds of the highlands of Rhone. Now, any of your listeners that have hiked the entire Appalachian Trail, remember the Highlands of Rhone section, because after hiking for about 400 miles through trees, they break out into grassy balds at elevations up to 6,000 feet and have views of several states and hundreds of miles and millions of acres of relatively pristine forest. It's a remarkable experience to be on these grassy balds. And my organization raised enormous amounts of money over the last 40 years to place this federal linear park unit on these grassy balds. And this mine was coming in on the closest facing ridge to one of the most beloved viewpoints on the Appalachian Trail. Would have been visible for 1.2 miles of walking. It also would have been audible during that time, which could be about 20 minutes of walking time to 30 minutes of walking time. And people also linger in that spot just because it's so scenic.
And it was your contention that not only was the trail in danger, but so was obviously Bellevue Mountain.
Yeah, that's right. And it's an interesting puzzle because Bellevue Mountain is privately owned. So the analogy that's, I think, useful to draw is other national park units where a threat emerges outside the park that impacts the user experience while you're inside the park. So Biscayne Bay, there was a famous case where jet skis were running up and down the surf along the beaches in the national park unit there, and people stopped using the beaches that were protected for their use and enjoyment, but it was impossible to use and enjoy the resource unless you put some sort of limits on the noise coming from jet skis. Similarly, at Yellowstone National Park, imagine a copper mine upstream on the Yellowstone River that would deposit copper into the river that would kill fish in the river. That's an impact that originates outside a unit that affects your use and enjoyment of the unit.
When you look at the case itself, when this word started to get out, how was the case changed, and how was your case bolstered by the fact that so many conservation groups then came on your side?
Well, it was enormously helpful. We were a tiny group from a tiny place on the map. We didn't have any political clout whatsoever. We couldn't even get our own county manager to agree with us, much less our county commissioners, who passed a resolution opposing our efforts. The local political class wanted jobs, and they wanted to widen roads. They thought that was important for economic development in Avery County, which is a pretty poor county in Appalachia. But very soon, as our case attracted the attention of other conservation groups, statewide, regionally, and then nationally, and the federal government, became something of a rallying cry for people who wanted to protect the ability to have rational regulation in places that it matters most, places where we've already invested public money.
As I mentioned, the dynamiting had already begun when you got involved. How much damage was done that was irreversible?
Well, that's a really good question. In my land trust work, we buy land for perpetuity, and we often buy land that's been timbered, and all of that heals. And the damage that was done to Bellevue Mountain will heal. It's ironic that the worst damage that was done to the mountain was done by the state of North Carolina to test to see how loud the impact would be on the Appalachian Trail, the acoustic impacts, and to give them a sense of how visible the damage would ultimately be as they started removing the mountain. So the state did a test blast and measured the acoustic impacts from the Appalachian Trail and took enormous numbers of pictures of what the impacts looked, and then did a visual analysis. And no surprise, they determined that it would significantly impact the user experience to have a active mining operation blowing up Bellevue Mountain and sending it through the jaws of a series of rock crushers.
But when was that done? That was done after it had already begun?
That was done after the blasting by the company had begun. The mining operation, in front of a judge, agreed to, quote, cool it while we work this out. The judge asked that they lay low and let us figure out what was going to be the ultimate disposition of the matter before they resumed tearing down the mountain. The mining company agreed to that, and the only blasting that happened after that was done by the state on a test basis. And interestingly, that judge, to this day, let's see, 11 years later, has still not ruled on that informal injunction.
And why is that?
Well, I think that the matter was so much in controversy, and there were parallel lawsuits going on at that point. I was sort of the coordinating attorney between two parallel efforts, one on our notice claim, and then ultimately the state joined us when they revoked the permit, which has never happened, by the way, once a mining permit was active. So suddenly we were on the same side as the state in one court and opposing the state in another court. And the judge in that case just sat on that injunction that he had gotten the mining company to agree to, and that kept the site quiet while we were in court for 4 years. So that was a real blessing.
So is the litigation done? Does this story have a happy ending, or is there still a possibility that there is some sort of ruling that could reverse what you have accomplished?
The action in the court is finished. We won a unanimous decision before the North Carolina Court of Appeals in 2004. The North Carolina Supreme Court then affirmed that decision by refusing to take it up again. The parties in the original action, Paul Brown, the mine company owner, has passed away. He died this year. The other principal in the case, who drew the mining map in a way that we claimed was fraudulent and denied the adjoining landowners of notice of their right, He was recently indicted by a federal grand jury on a land fraud scheme charge that was only related to this incidentally. He tried to open this quarry 6 miles south next to the Blue Ridge Parkway, another national park, as part of land that he gained through an illegal fraud scheme.
So the question, I guess, that I think of is, when it comes to the Clark Stone Company, are they done, or is there a possibility of other areas that they can move to?
Well, they are actually done. They sold their mining equipment, and the principals, as I say, are either deceased or awaiting sentencing. And Randy Carpenter's sentencing guideline for the crimes he committed is 38 years. So we're not going to be hearing from that outfit. But I think the question, the bigger, more important question is, this kind of threat from encroaching development on a very fragile linear park unit never ends. And while there are threats encroaching on each of the 2,400 miles of the Appalachian Trail, there are also local constituencies for each of those miles. And there are local trail clubs, maintainers through the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, and other hiking clubs that pitch in to manage this trail and protect it. And we were one small group and one critical, beloved part of the trail, but there are heroes up and down this unit that are keeping an eye on it and trying to protect it for future generations.
I would assume that conservation groups across this country who are trying to wage similar battles against companies and to ensure that environmental beauty and nature be preserved look at this as an example of what can be done when a group of people get together and fight.
We get asked the question all the time. Ashley and Ollie get phone calls from people who are concerned about asphalt plants going in next to their homes in other parts of the state and really across the country, and be it landfills or stump dumps. People who do not like environmental regulation, you try to put an asphalt plant next to their house, you've got a new champion for rational regulation and land use planning. And that's been very, very inspiring, but there are constant reminders of how many threats there are out there to people's sense of peace and quiet, and either in their homes or in the natural places that are left where people go to clear their heads.
The name of the book is Stand Up That Mountain, The Battle to Save One Small Community in the Wilderness Along the Appalachian Trail. It is published by Scribner. Jay Luzzi, I thank you very much for spending time with us, and I wish you all the luck with the book and with your future efforts.
Thank you, Joe. I'll be on the trail this weekend, hoping for good weather.
Thank you very much. Good to know that you're out there. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Stand Up That Mountain. It is published by Scribner. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.